Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, think sexual revolution, and we think of the 60s, of course, the era when Elvis' gyrating hips gave way to the pouting of Mick Jagger and the brazen advocacy of Hugh Hefner, when the availability of the pill made possible the hippie vision of so-called free love. And some social analysts discern the roots of what we're calling today the sexual revolution earlier than the 60s, in the 40s and 50s, and I've no doubt the roots are discernible there. But however we precisely date its origins, there's no doubt that it was the 60s when today's sexual revolution really gained momentum, traction. And since then, over the past half century indeed, the moral and relational settlement that had prevailed really for centuries has comprehensively broken down. And we might posit that that settlement was based on three key propositions. First, that gender is binary and to be received as such. Second, that sexual interests are normatively expressed heterosexually between sexes. And thirdly, that human flourishing is linked to the ordering of sexual intimacy within the covenant of marriage. Those, I think, are the three core propositions of the settlement that had prevailed culturally in Western culture over many centuries. And we have seen what I'd suggest is narrative collapse, the collapse of that settlement narrative that I've outlined in just half of one century. I think there are two critical strands to this narrative collapse. The first is a cultural revolution or profound cultural change, which has result in a revolution of ideas, thought, and cultural behaviours. And one can illustrate this by simple observations in the culture around us. Here we have a main street of Bristol, my hometown. Here we have Anne Summers, which is well known in Britain, Great Britain. I'm not so sure on the continent. Certainly it's not so well known on the Eastern continent. But this is a chain of stores that sits in the high street, okay? And our children can wander past, and young people and older people, and you can see you can buy your whips and your chains here, and these are highly provocative dresses and sex toys and sex clothes and so on in this shop. What 50 years ago was hidden in a basement in Soho is now available in the high street. And it's a powerful icon of the cultural strand of this revolution. Here we have the previous mayor of Bristol. Here we have a civic dignitary representing the mainstream of civic respectability being kissed on either side by two Bangkok ladyboys, which are something of a phenomena in England as they tour with what I'm told is a spectacular show, a cabaret variety show. The ladyboys, as you know, are a mixture of transgendered, transsexual young men and also simply straightforward transvestites and showmen. And you'll find there a variety of configurations of human anatomy ranging from those who've had the full sex change operation through to those who are simply cross-dressing, boys who are fully biologically still typical boys, but cross-dressing, with the intermediate of some who will have had still retain a penis, but have had breast implants. So we have a range, a smorgasbord of sexual ontology, of sexual being, of presentation in this kind. And what we have is the mainstreaming of this degree of diversity with civic respectability. And here we have the wife of the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Sarah Brown, the previous Prime Minister, and we see her here in a gay pride March, once again, not only giving civic respectability, but really governmental sanction and approval and support, and indeed celebration of sexual diversity in these many forms. And we need to understand that the acceleration of the sexual revolution that we've probably witnessed over the past 15 years, really, this really accelerated in the past 15 years, involves the liberation of the self from any notion of participation in some natural order of things. That's the key. We've seen the liberation of the notion that the self participates in some natural order of things, some road of expectation that we should walk on. The final removal of the scaffolding of moral obligation and cultural sanction around the development of sexual desire. That's what we've witnessed, setting humans free to self-construct in line with personal choice. All that matters is that two people love one another. And to understand the scale of this cultural transformation, we need to consider the theory, the vision that drives it. And this is rooted in queer theory. Now, queer theory is an academic discipline. It's rooted in the work of Michel Foucault, and more recently Judith Butler, our key exponents. And it is an ingenious use of the term queer, which of course was taken from we Christians, because as we know, the term Christian was originally used as a term of abuse, people who followed a crucified criminal, someone strung up, Christians. And of course we wore that label as a term of pride and identity. And similarly, the queer movement has taken, when I was a child, the term queer was a term of exclusion, of denigration, of debasement of somebody else. It's queer. Queer. Is he a queer? And people took on the receiving end of that exclusion, that label, and they wore it with pride. And queer theory isn't simply about the acceptance of a place of exclusion, but it's about the advocacy, indeed the celebration of diversity and inclusion. And the theory, queer theory, is basically the academic underpinning of these kind of phenomena of sexual diversity. I suppose, you know, these sort of images express the pursuit of fluidity, diversity, the deconstruction of gender or expectations of heteronormativity, that there's some normal road, that route of sexual expression that we're expected to participate in. And of course, we'll watch the Eurovision Song Contest. Did anybody watch the Eurovision Song Contest? And here we have the, you know, the cultural mainstreaming of this of queer theory. That this is queer theory come, that it's the time, it's come of age. That it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, how you have reconfigured yourself today, as long as two people, or maybe three or four, love each other. And so we have the profound phenomenon of narrative collapse. I should say, by the way, I forgot to mention the second feature of this revolution, of the sexual revolution. The first is a cultural revolution. The second is a moral revolution. And it's quite important to grasp this. This revolution is not amoral. It is not without moral vision. It has a profound and imaginative moral vision. This revolution isn't a revolution with no values. It's a revolution that's adopted different values and morals, and they are equality, diversity, freedom of expression, and authentic individuality. It's those three-legged components of this moral revolution that actually carries quite important persuasive power for many young people today. So nobody wants to be few people want to be amoral, and this revolution carries within it the possibility that, the promise that standing within it, there is a morality still, the pursuit of equality and fairness, of diversity and freedom of expression, authenticity, individualism. Okay? So, I'll stop in a minute and we can chip in our thoughts and ideas, but I think it's worth pausing just over the speed of this phenomenon in Western culture, because as one looks around Eastern Europe, one can see quite different social settlements at the moment, quite entrenched homophobia, and traditional values that appear still to be held in the mainstream. And it might appear on the face of it that these are going to change, if at all, only very slowly. And I think the key message is, do not be deceived at the speed at which things may yet change in Eastern Europe. And I want to illustrate this with Peter Tatchell, who's an advocacy of queer theory in the UK. And Peter Tatchell, this was his vision back in 1994. So we're talking 20 years ago, all right? And he had a vision, like Martin Luther King. He foresaw a time when male-female relationships would become more of a conscious choice and a rational pleasure, rather than a traditional expectation and moral obligation. In other words, rather than participating in some moral ordering, we would in fact choose the nature of our relationships. To change from a heterocentric culture to a sexually pluralistic one is in everyone's interest. That was his vision, 1994, just 20 years ago. Okay? 4 years later, here's Peter Tatchell, and he's invading the pulpit on Easter Sunday morning as the Archbishop of Canterbury is delivering his Easter message. Now, this man has vision, he has energy, he has passion, he has determination and commitment. And yet still, he's on the outside, and the church is very much still on the inside, in the mainstream of popular culture. Okay? He's still got his vision, but he's the guy with the placards, he's the guy who's the protester. The police are about to come and rustle this lot away, shuffle, get them away out of the door. And standing in the pulpit will remain the Archbishop of Canterbury. That was then, all right? 15 years ago, that's all. 15 years ago. 2002, Section 28 was still in force when it was made illegal to promote homosexuality in schools. 12 years ago. Okay. Now just, well, after 1998, 15 years later, Peter Tatchell, a national hero, a civil rights campaigner we can all applaud, heroic, an example to us all, Richard Holloway, a modern-day prophet, former Primate of Scotland. Sean McBride, former Assistant General Secretary of the United Nations. He is a challenging government repression and public panic. Talking about Peter. And here he is getting one of his two honorary doctorates. Kate Allen, Director, Amnesty International. Brave and courageous, Peter has unflinchingly exposed the depth of homophobia that still haunts this planet. For in just 12 years, an outsider being shoveled outside by the police to a national hero. And now it's the Archbishop of Canterbury who's on the outside in the sense of the gay marriage debate. It's said that he was stunned by the scale of the defeat of the church's resistance to the gay marriage proposal, the gay marriage legislation, as it went through the House of Lords. And as the that debate broke down, the bishops repaired, they went over onto the terrace, and they looked into the scale of the defeat that they had just witnessed. Now it was they who are on the outside, potentially the bigots, homophobes, the excluded, the odd, the marginal. 15 years, massive, speedy cultural change. And of course, what is happening now is we're seeing the breakdown of that, those old labels of gay and straight. And do you remember I suggested that the first leg of that settlement that prevailed for so many centuries was that gender is binary? Well, we saw in the Eurovision contest the deconstruction of that notion. The second was some sense of heteronormativity, that the normal expression of sexual interest is between a man and a woman and a man. It's heterosexual. Well, we're seeing the breakdown of that now with the abandonment of the old labels. We're seeing first the multiplication of them, and then as we exhaust the number of labels, the abandonment of them. So you have lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, questioning, intersex, asexual, F. Anyway, you know, post-sexual. In fact, young people today, they just say, we don't like any of these, we're just queer. We don't want anybody to label us, you see. And this is from the New York Times, Generation LGBTQIA. And this is the queering of society. And of course, we need to pause to think about the costs of this narrative collapse. Belief in marriage in England, only 50% of those 25 years ago believe a couple should marry before having children now. This is the British Social Attitudes Survey 2013. 50% children conceived outside of marriage. 3 million children in the United Kingdom live in single-parent homes. Most of those will be fatherless, a generation of fatherless children, boys with no stable male role model, girls with no stable male example in their lives. And when people talk about inequality, I find myself saying, this is an inequality that I'm interested in, the inequality we've heaped on the heads of these 3 million children as we've deprived them of a mother and father. And of course, those of us interested in social inequality know that one of the greatest causes of social inequality and income inequality, indeed, is single parent inequality, of single parent homes. Only 50% of children reach age 16 with both parents. This is an appalling statistic. Half of children reach the age of 15 with both parents. And as I was saying this morning in our network, record numbers of people in the age 45 to 64 years now live alone because of divorce in the baby boomer generation, my generation. We were sharing this morning how C.S. Lewis's chilling vision, if you remember, in The Great Divorce. The Great Divorce has a picture of hell in which you simply need to think of a reality and it's yours. So if you fall out with somebody, you just think of a new house if they're too close to yours, and you can have one. You can have any house you like. You can have a palace, a big palace with grounds. But of course, the effect of this is you're pushed further away from people as new homes are being invented to deal with our inability to live together. And C.S. Lewis's picture of hell is that we drift further and further into isolation, alone with ourselves. And we're seeing this in some way realized before our eyes in society today, as people live alone in one-bedroom flats, two-bedroom flats, the breakdown of homes. And so these are the costs of narrative collapse that we need to bear in mind. And actually, thinking of C.S. Lewis, I don't know whether many of you read his book, The Abolition of Man. And in The Abolition of Man, Lewis wrote about the Tao, which is the Eastern concept of the way or code of behavior that is in harmony with the natural order. And in the book, Lewis set out his belief that there's a set of values that broadly, with some variation and exception, but broadly, there is a set of values that have been shared with minor differences by every culture. I quote him, the traditional moralities of East and West, the Christian, the pagan, and the Jew. And Lewis sort of lumped these together under the concept of Tao. And he foresaw a distant future when he was writing in the 40s, 50s, in which the values of natural law, the Tao, would have collapsed and been, as he put it, debunked, one of his favorite words, and replaced by the control of a cultural elite who would purport to rule by a perfect understanding of psychology and who had the ability to see through the old natural order of things and place it with something more perfect and psychologically and scientifically valid and robust. And I wonder how shocked Lewis would have been if he could have foreseen how close that distant future actually was. It was just 50 years away, 60 years away, at least in relation to the defeat of traditional sexual morality. Love to get, just pause for a moment, get some of your wisdom, thoughts, chip in, questions at this point. Yes.
I know we were tempted to look back to other periods like ancient Rome. What other time periods could you look at that there's enough data to make some observations of long-term social impact? In the U.S., the only guy, Rick Regis, yeah, it's the only person I know, and I know he's gotten shot down.
You know, I think it raises an important point that we ought to be deploying social science data better than we do. And there is a problem, of course. We'd love to believe that science is objective, that it's white coat, men in white coats surveying the data objectively, generating hypotheses and publishing their results in a neutral way. But it's far from that. Within science, of course, there are hierarchies of prestige which determine whose papers get prominence and whose don't and what gets published and what doesn't. And then if you add in the filter of what makes it through into popular culture via the press and those who control media, and we get a very distorted view of what's there. And so often the results of social sciences particularly, which involve the interpretation of quite complex data, you know, you have to build up from data sets into narrative stories of what's going on. We often get quite distorted final sets of data or impressions of what's going on. So we do need, you know, sharp use of social data. Martin Regnerus actually, you know, he was shot down, but he was shot. I don't think he was shot down. He's a tough guy, he's a very bright guy, he's an American researcher, and he's looked at the potential impacts of gay adoption on children. And now that is an open question, in my view. The data just aren't good enough for us to draw firm conclusions either way. But of course, the popular social, the narrative out there is that science has comprehensively shown that this has no impact on children. The study is so small, so biased, so methodologically problematic that I just don't think you can draw that conclusion. But neither do I think you can draw the conclusion that you can show harm at the moment. The studies just don't stack up. But we need to get behind these guys in prayer. I think as they are swimming against the cultural tide in producing these data. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's think about the church's response to this. And I want to suggest to you that the church's response has been a three-legged stool of failure. And the three legs of this stool are the problem of our shame culture, the problem of our intellectual poverty, and I'm thinking of the evangelical church particularly, and our apologetics failure in this area. You will get the most imaginative apologetics in cosmology, but when did you last hear some really sharp, neat apologetics of what our narrative is in the area of human sexuality? I don't know any. All right, we're seeing the first green shoots, but let's look at these. We have a real problem with our shame culture. This is, I love this picture because it's the way many Christian boys walk into their sexuality, and girls too, even today. Unintroduced to their bodies and the way they work, a culture of shame, a denigration of the body, that somehow the body is dirty, sex is dirty, it doesn't belong in the sphere of spirituality, faith, and it's certainly the case in Eastern Europe. It's breaking down more helpfully now in Western Europe, but I guess if I asked most of us to talk about the sex education we got from our parents, it wouldn't be very enlightening. And most of our young people still walk into their sexuality in shame and ignorance. And this is really to our huge cost, but to our shame that we allow this to happen. But it does mean that we can't engage with our culture because we don't talk about it amongst ourselves, let alone about engage externally with our culture. And what I want to suggest to you is that our young people are actually saddled today with two types of shame which converge to produce our paralysis, or might I say the hemorrhaging of many young evangelicals now. First, what I've talked about here, inward-facing shame. The one I've talked about, deep distrust of the body and pleasure and intimacy. So most of our young people are launched into this sexual revolution with their iPhones in hand, in ignorance about how to function as sexual beings. But this is compounded by what we could call outward-looking shame or contextual shame. By this, I mean that our young people are seen as an immoral minority because they belong to a church that is now seen as being an immoral minority. And it's deeply uncomfortable. Nobody likes to feel that. This is the nature of Phariseeism. People don't like to feel or to be seen to be immoral. And so our young people feel shame in church. They feel shame outside the church because they're perceived as belonging to a homophobic, bigoted, excluding, grubby organization that belongs to yesterday's consensus. And it's very hard to swim against the tide. It's really hard. We are deeply imitative creatures, deeply imitative. You know, the sociologist Peter Berger talked about cognitive minorities. And he said that he was interested in the sociology of ideas. All ideas emerge in social discourse, or certainly are perpetuated in social discourse, he said. You know, ideas are kept going in conversation, in books, in writing. And those ideas that prosper will be those that receive the assent of the majority. In fact, he went on to coin that term, plausibility structures. The ideas that prosper are those that are supported by what he called plausibility structures. In other words, the structures that make the ideas sound plausible or good, or, hey, everybody believes that round here, don't they? You see, so a plausible argument has that ring to it that, hey, we all know that. At a dinner party, everyone's nodding around the table because we all know that. We all give assent to that idea. And so the most plausible ideas are those that are held as generally acceptable within the conversational fabric of a society. That's what Peter Berger said, you know, one of the most famous recent sociologists. And what supports that plausibility that's given to the idea, the structures, are, he said, opinion formers within a society, the thought leaders, those who control the media and make those ideas fashionable and mainstream, persuasive, interesting, colourful, full of imagery and inspiration. And perhaps, you know, most of all, it's that hidden sense of the, well, everybody knows this. Once there's a tipping point in which an idea achieves that level of, well, everybody knows this, don't they, and gives a sense of this. Once you've achieved that tipping point, it's very hard to resist. And those who try to hold opposite ideas to what is now given plausibility in a culture is called a cognitive minority. Now, Peter Berger said, no cognitive minority can survive unless it actively nurtures those ideas of difference within that minority group. So Orthodox Jews, they bring up their boys. They make sure their boys know their faith as well as the girls. The fathers take their boys to the Wailing Wall to pray with them. The men see it as their responsibility to disciple the boys into the way in which they should go. There's no doubt that there's a Tao in Orthodox Judaism. Same with traditional Catholicism. And yet we as evangelicals, we leave our young people at the mercy of popular culture because of our internal shame culture, you see. And Peter Berger said, very interestingly, what happens to a cultural minority or a cognitive minority that doesn't sustain its own ideas amongst its own people is this. The first people to peel away are the most relational. Because they're the ones who find it most difficult, because of their empathy with other people, to be perceived as sort of bigoted and different. And at a dinner table, party table, they want to be seen to be part of their I told you. We all know that group. They want to belong. They're relational, you see. So the most relational peel away first. That leaves the less relational, the more left brain, people who like words in rows, who are less feely-touchy, who are more comfortable with being, you know, sticking out like a sore thumb. Who cares? They're not relational. Which means that the few relational people who are left in the cognitive minority look round at their new friends and they say, hey, I think I like the cognitive majority more than this lot that I'm stuck with now. So they peel away. And Berger said, so your cognitive minority either implodes completely or it becomes an authoritarian rump. And we're in profound danger in the evangelical world of just that outcome. And we're seeing the peeling away of young evangelicals. Very often our thought leaders and opinion leaders at media, who are influencing the media, are peeling away. They're taking young people with them because they look attractive and they use words well. And if you want to imitate someone, I think I'd prefer to imitate him than that sad old professor who's rabbiting on about all the diseases these people get, which to our young people feels grubby and dirty and sort of, you know, negative and yesterday. When we have the Prime Minister's wife and the Mayor of Bristol and we have all of popular culture and popular media casting a much more interesting vision than those left in the cognitive minority. And so we can see as a church how our shame culture is leading to the loss of our young people because we're not retaining, we're not building our own alternative vision. Who can blame them for going off? And that's our shame culture, which is the first leg of failure. The second is our intellectual poverty in this area. Evangelical teaching in the sphere of marriage, the family, our understanding of the body, human sexuality. We've got relatively few theologians, for example, with the resources, the intellectual capacity, the interest to mount a credible response to queer theory. What young, sharp, motivated, culturally aware, engaged theologians are mounting any kind of credible response to queer theory. We didn't prepare intellectually for this cultural revolution. And of course, the academics we have among us have themselves been hampered by the shame. They're shamed into keeping quiet. And so these things aren't fashionable to get into. It's not a way to advance your career within academia. Although I'd like to suggest that queer theory may be a way in which we can begin to mount a challenge, because there is a credible intellectual case to be made against it, or at least to engage with it, I believe. Now, compared with this, the Catholics have their great tradition of natural theology. Any of you that have seen John Paul II's monumental piece of work, The Theology of the Body, he was the most profound teacher on human sexuality. And if you can get hold of some of his, you might call expounders, the book's unintelligible, I find. Totally unintelligible. But there are two or three people who are full-time expounders of theology of the body, and they're well worth hearing. Christopher West is one. If you go to Christopher West's website, he's a Catholic, and he talks like an evangelical. And I'd really recommend, with a few, your brows will furrow and there'll be some question marks over some aspects of Catholic theology that slip out. But if you can just ride over those, there's some wonderful material there from Christopher West. Now, we have to engage with this intellectually, I believe. But third and finally, and you're being very patient with me, our apologetic failure. And I hinted at this earlier. You know, we're great on cosmology. Richard Dawkins, we love it, debating him. But we have so little in the way of plausible apologetics in this area. And sexuality has been left to an older, more conservative generation who are simply less adept at communicating with younger people or the new, with our generation. Elderly talking heads. Traditional looking websites that carry negative, excluding messages. Our approach has looked cold, as if we don't care, we lack compassion. And so we list the diseases that gay people get, as if this is going to win hearts and minds. Friends, what I want to suggest to you is that queer advocacy and gay advocacy understand the human heart. I think they understand the biblical doctrine of the human heart better than we do. They understand that we're persuaded not simply by cold intellectual argument, but by vision. The heart wants to be inspired. Jonathan Edwards saw that. The great task of the preacher, he said, is to inspire, to move the hearts of his people to joy and love, you see. And they understand that the heart is moved by other factors than simple intellectual argument, by our emotion, by an inspiring vision, and by an appeal to the heart's desire to at least appear to be morally credible and to be compassionate and to be socially acceptable. What do I mean? Well, what I want is a video called Homecoming. It's had, I think, 1.5 million hits. And it's, I think it lasts about a minute, and it simply makes the case for gay marriage, okay? And I first came across it because it was tweeted by a columnist, a young columnist in the Times, called Tim Montgomery, the Times of England and of London. And he just simply tweeted, "This says everything to me." Okay? "This says everything to me." It kicks off with this group of soldiers come down the steps. They're returning from Afghanistan. "They've been fighting for you out there. So we're already on their side." As they come down the steps, there's this rather nice young chap that most mothers would love for their daughter to bring home for Sunday lunch. And this group of of guys gets to the bottom and their girlfriends and wives and children rush to meet them. And they sweep them up in their arms and they carry them off, except this chap here. Nobody rushes to meet him. But as his friend his wife comes up and falls into his arms, this guy pats him on the back, just touches him like that. And the message is, good on you, mate. Good for you. Go and spend time with your wife. So now I'm asking, this man who's been fighting for me, what about him? What's good for him? And I'm feeling compassionate toward him. And then, boom, 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 the music starts, you see. And we spot another guy who's waiting. And then we rush toward each other in slow motion. And I find I want to say, I hope this guy's going to marry him or some such thing. You see, it's a beautifully set up piece of propaganda. And they fall into each other's arms, they kiss, one gets out a ring, and the music builds and then it fades. And just four words come on the screen: all men can be heroes. And what's really interesting is Tim Montgomery tweeted, "This says everything to me." But in fact, it said nothing. There was no voice, no words being spoken. There were four words on the screen at the end, but the impact of that is entirely visual. It's to the heart. And those who are making the case understand that the heart longs to be inspired, that it's less easily persuaded by cold, rational argument expressed in propositions, and more easily persuaded when that argument is cast as an inspiring vision. And they know this, so they use visuals to inspire us, music to raise our emotions, narrative to catch our attention, and morality to appeal to our sense of fair play. What's the morality here? They're appealing to your sense of compassion and fairness. You feel sorry for the guy who's been fighting for you. He taps the other guy on the back. He's fair, you know, it's good for him to get married. Why isn't it good for him? And so it appeals to our moral intuitions. It's very, very clever. And we need to take this seriously and to think about the way it's being done. This says everything to me. What do we have in the way of apologetics that has that kind of impact and appeal? So, where do we go with this, friends? My wife says at this point, Glenn, everyone's getting so depressed, you need to sort of do something here. And so we won't quite stop at this point. We'll try and keep going. But let's break. Any comments, any wisdom or points, questions? It's a great question from Martin. I is there more to come, or may we be reaching the point at which the pendulum swings back? What do others think on that? I'd be really... Anyone, any thoughts on that? Yes, can you just shout if you can?
Well, my view, I was at the centre of the marriage redefinition debate. And I think since we have this new social orthodoxy, I think we've got a whole lot more to come in an immediate sense. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we shouldn't plan now for how this cycle runs, because as Charles Morris knows it, this whole sexual revolution is a fad and a trend, and it will come and it will go.
Mm. You think there's more to come? Yeah. Chris?
My slightly cynical thought is that pressure on public finances will lead some opinion leaders to want to start promoting longevity and stability of relationships, if not heterosexuality of relationships, because of the growing burden of
any, thank you, yes. Any Thoughts, comments on that? Dan, yeah, Daniel.
Yeah, I'd say this a long way to go. Remembering that we haven't detected greed here yet.
Mm.
It has made a push and we are where we are because of greed here. It's already past where we are, we know that. And there's no one that coalface dealing with where they're at in health policy, education policy. And, you know, you can go to the more liberal countries, Scandinavia, they're already deeply embedded, but it's not recognised. So it's there and it's coming.
And it's all hanging on you, Daniel. Daniel's starting a PhD in queer theory, thankfully, so that's going to be fantastic. Yeah. Yes. Yes, thank
you. I think sometimes if you look at Foucault and queer theory and sort of constructivism of identity and identity politics, it follows that as kind of the front edge of this. My experience with the gay marriage issue was the tiny percentage of the population imposing this open morality on everybody else, and democratically as well. Most of the people that were supporting gay marriage weren't really interested in gay people or in marriage. This is, for me, it's just another instrument for secular humanism to attack Christian values as much as anything else in public life. And I think that's worth being aware of.
So in a way, whilst you'd accept the notion that queer theory is a powerful driver, you're seeing lots of other powerful interests piggybacking in on this as a way of deconstructing the Christian settlement that there's been
a
for
way
the past.
That people, you know, it's a whole liberal progressive agenda. If you can legitimise these forms of behaviours and moralities, then that makes me far less accountable for how I live my life and spend my money, and I think that's what's at the root of this.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Any other? My own thought on how much further to go is I'm not sure, to be honest, because I think we're not sure what the end game is going to be with. We're in an uncharted territory, particularly with children. And I just wonder at what point people will begin to say, hang on a moment, the impact, the burden we're placing on children, this is getting out of hand. The other issue is that the loss of any sense of norm, the normative, really does pose big problems for parenting and schooling. And we are seeing more children, apparently, who are cross-dressing, and believing that they're in the wrong body and so on. Now, some of those will be just the kind of phenomenon that we've seen for decades, what you'd call transgenderism, you know, kids who do feel from a very early age. But many more of them will simply be a product of this relaxation in our culture of any sense of tau or norm, or this is the way to walk in. And so parents, as they take off that sort of cultural conditioning or expectation, will suddenly begin to wonder where we're going with all this. Or I think, Daniel, what you said, what's the end game? And it may be the end game will come much faster than, you know, the sense of perplexity about this will develop much more quickly and may begin the swing back. The other thing that does make me wonder is that in the Mozilla case, you know, where Ike was his name, the chief executive of Mozilla, he resigned after only 2 weeks because it was found that he'd donated money, £700, to an anti-gay marriage campaign 3 years ago, I think it was. And he was forced to resign after a campaign against him. Looking at the Twitter response to that, a lot of gay opinion leaders, you know, the cultural elites who've been so prominent, were deeply uncomfortable with what was done to Ike. And, for example, one tweet I saw from one of them says, I didn't fight to get gays out of the closet to put Christians back into it. And so that sense of fair play that humans do have, being made in the image of God, even though it's defaced and broken in all kinds of ways, does often, you know, kick in as we look on the repercussions of this. And it may be, and certainly I saw an article the other way, cracks in the gay consensus, it was called. So the so-called gay community, that there's a cracking appear as, to be honest with you, some socially conservative gay people are looking at the revolution that queer theory is driving and say, but I didn't sign up for this. I thought I could just take the virtues of marriage, switch them into what I wanted to give validity to my relationship with my partner, and that everything would pretty much then carry on as normal. And I think there are those within the gay community who are appalled by what queer theory is doing socially. But this is now out of hand. We are in uncharted territory. The tower's been lost, and it'll be interesting to see where we go. It's a great question, isn't it? Yes. Richard. Yes, Richard, I got it right, sorry.
To what you were saying that last time about the community and being a teacher, I remember talking and counseling with an older teenager who had same-sex attraction, and he said, I'm forced to go into the gay pubs because that's where we don't talk about it. Either people talk about it and shut away from it. I'm forced to go to the gay discos, where usually older men kind of get off with it, he said. I am forced to dress in a certain way if I want to be part of that community. I don't want to be part of that community. Mm. I just have a same-sex attraction as a young person. And I think that, again, is the other shame thing there. Where can these people go just to be accepted?
Yeah, yeah. Great point. Can I just take one more, and then I'll better just carry on? Yes, please. Thank you.
Identifying the segments of the gay community,
yes,
and segments that are attracted you have a dialogue with, as opposed to those are,
yes,
like queer theory.
It's a great point, and of course a wonderful opportunity for apologetics as well, because within the gay community people say, I don't like what I see in queer theory. The question is, well, why not? You know, what's the basis on which we order our lives? Have you thought about this? And then we begin to talk about the Christian vision as we see it, which brings me on to what we need to do. And I think as church we need to regain a positive vision. And that positive vision, I believe, has to pivot around a conviction that what we have, the Christian narrative, isn't simply, we're not compelled by this vision because we just think it's good for us. That's the big mistake we've made. We're always arguing, yet, you know, we seem to be crying about the persecution and we can't somehow conserve our position, as if we're worried about what's good for us. I believe we need to recover a sense of conviction that the Christian vision is good for everybody, not just ourselves. And, you know, Martin Luther King had this conviction, this genius, I think, that he was able to advocate that the defeat of racism wasn't just good for the black community. That his genius was saying, no, this isn't about us, this is about everybody, the defeat of racism. It's good for whites as well as the black community. And we need to recover, or maybe reimagine, a way of communicating the fact that we care. This is because we care. And we're compassionate. And I think if you think of the assisted dying debate, this is going to be the next big one that's coming down, hurtling down on us, assisted suicide. We are more used, and the mainstream churches are used to saying that, yes, we feel compassionate about the needs of the few, those who are in dreadful terminal conditions who are suffering, but we mustn't fix the needs of the few at the expense of the consequences for the many, or at the expense of the many in terms of the consequences of that. Do you see that? We've traditionally argued we don't just introduce assisted suicide to meet the needs of the few, because the repercussions on the many in terms of the social changes that would follow, I'll pick up in a sec, Chris, will be so huge. So we're used in that debate to balancing the needs of the few against the many. Now, what we have to do, I believe, is look at the consequences of the sexual revolution, talk less about the gay issue, but the whole sexual revolution, and say, look at the consequence, the 3 million people, kids, the people living alone. It's for their sake that we believe in the goodness of the Christian vision for human flourishing. This is about the flourishing of all of us. And yes, of course, there are hard cases. There are people we wish weren't broken in this way, but we're all broken in different ways. And we have to regain the ability to convey our compassion for the few, but also for the many who've been affected by the sexual revolution. So I think that's an important part of our positive vision. But also maybe, do we need to, friends, regain our own confidence in the Christian vision? You know, many of us will have begun to, I meet conservative young evangelicals who are saying, do you think we've got this right, Glyn? You know, might we be wrong on this issue? And maybe this is over the gay issue, but maybe we do need to revisit our narrative, our whole understanding of what we believe to be the Christian vision for human flourishing. It is. And that means teaching it in our churches. It means talking about it. It means defeating this culture of shame that we struggle with. And of course, it's about vision and it's about inspiration. In the end of the day, a general doesn't check the armor and weapons of his troops, doesn't it? You know, a general is leading his men into battle. He doesn't say, okay, let's count the number of guns we've got, or let's count the number of tanks. When he gathers his men and prepares them to vision for battle, he motivates their hearts with vision at that point. He fires the imagination of what we're fighting for, the world we want to see achieved, you see? Or in Ephesians, Paul introduces the weapons at the end, but the first three chapters is about vision. And in just the same way here, we need a new imaginative response to sexual revolution that has all of the energy and confidence of a counter-revolution, a rediscovery, a renaissance of the biblical vision for human flourishing that's colourful, confident, has conviction, belief. And of course we have to be clear what the negatives are. Lust is sex in the wrong context, and idolatry is sex for the wrong purpose. But we need to be ready to talk then about what sex in the right context is, and what it looks like, and why we think it's a good thing, and what sex for the right purpose looks like. And we need to recover our confidence in sex as something sacred and good, an icon of the relations within the Trinity itself, an icon of the passion that Jesus has for his church. Sex as an anticipation. The joys of sex are never quite enough, because of course they always point beyond to the ecstasy, the joys of consummation, union with God himself. And then a divine seal on the divine mandate to fill the world, to prosper, to have children, a divine seal on that. So we need to recover our vision in words, in pictures, in conviction, and in passion. Second, in models. First in vision, second in models. That means that we show what we tell. I don't know whether you've seen the work of Rodney Stark, who was a sociologist. Very interesting, his book, The Rise of Christianity. He wasn't a Christian when he wrote that book, at least I don't think so. But Rodney Stark asked the question, how did this little Jesus movement rise in just 3-4 centuries to become a world powerful religion? What happened? And of course the popular narrative is that Constantine was converted so everybody fell into line, you see. Rodney Stark doesn't believe that. He makes the opposite case, that Constantine in fact fell into line with an unstoppable movement at that point. And Rodney Stark believes that the central doctrines of this is not a Christian writer. The central doctrines of Christianity, he says, prompted and sustained attractive, liberating, and effective social relations and organizations that the pagans saw and they wanted. They saw the way we treated our women, and their women wanted that, and they joined, and then they brought their men. They saw the way that we treated our sick, particularly in the great great epidemics that swept through the empire. There were three big epidemics that wiped out huge groups of people. Christians stayed in the cities. They cared for the sick. And they saw that, and they liked it, and they wanted it. And so Stark's point was, yes, we had our core doctrinal convictions, which we nurtured and sustained, but yes, we lived that in a way that the pagans ultimately saw and wanted for themselves. And a social conservative talks about the Benedict option that faces we traditional Christians just now. What he says is, in this gathering moral dark age, maybe just as the Benedictines conserved the word and lived the life of Christ in their communities, we in our communities must preserve the word that we believe to be good for human flourishing and show how it's true in our children, in our families, in our communities, the way we welcome in gay people, the way we look after the broken and the marginal and the outcast, the way that we model the ability to have a conviction but to love the person who we believe to be in error and to welcome them in and serve them. And the Benedict option is perhaps the way, a kind of an arc through which God will then one day bring his word to prosper once again. So in vision, in models, and by the way, this is, I think, a green shoot of an apologetics comeback that we're beginning to see. This is an English development. This is a website called Living Out, and this, in distinction to all the other websites that have been, you see there's what you might call the gay script, which is, you know, there's gay and straight and you're one or the other, and all of the rights that are the other should now belong to the gays, and that's it. There's this binary of gay and straight. Then there's the ex-gay script, which is that Christianity is about deliverance from being gay, the conversion of a whole self, a switch from straight to gay, gay to straight, you see. Living Out, I think, is a third way. It doesn't follow either of those scripts. It says we're dealing in reality and truth. Some of us have these are Christians who go onto camera and talk about their sexuality. I don't guess that many of us would like to go on camera and talk about their sex life. These heroes are willing to do that for you and me. And they're talking about their experience of same-sex attraction. And they're pretty high production values, well presented, and they're simply saying, can I tell you my story? This is how it is for me. And I believe this is the path to human flourishing. So if you Google Living Out, it's the top Google hit. They had 17,000 hits within the first week. It's got a lot of attention, and that's an example, I think, of our not only telling but showing, demonstrating that what we believe is plausible. And then finally, and I'm just finished in apologetics, and we need younger people, not old people. We want to see young role models, young intellectuals up here at this forum making these arguments with passion and conviction. We need intellectually vigorous young people engaged with these, who are deploying data from the social sciences and dynamized by this positive vision for human flourishing. We need some great films. We need some great visuals. We need to put some money into this. In the first instance, to retain our own young people, but with the longer vision that we have something that we believe is good for everybody. I'm so sorry, I'm getting very preachy now, so I'll stop. You can get these slides from this humbly named website, glynharrison.com, and that's the password, capital ELF2014. Yes?
Well, how can we make our young people survive? Any practical help?
Yeah, I think ownership of the responsibility. You know, I think it's parents' responsibility to introduce their kids to their sexual experience, the understanding of their body, and what we believe to be the moral way of Christ in the ordering of us. I think owning, if you don't take that responsibility, there are plenty of people out there ready to shape their hearts and minds. And so we need to own that responsibility. It's a deeply serious responsibility that goes to fathers as well as mothers. If we have boys, I think it's the father particularly. There are some great resources out there, some of them secular, but you know, there are different resources to help. And we've probably got to start at the age of, what do you think? Five, I agree. Five, six. We've got to get in there before the world gets in there, and it'll get, well, they'll walk past Ann Summers, you know, on the main street. Five or six. And our instincts are saying, oh, no, we don't want our kids to know about sex. That may just be shameful view of sex. Why not? Why not? Yes, Chris.
The deluge of pornography
that's available to the internet. Yeah. The consequences of the sexual revolution, the pornification of society, is one of the huge, you know, consequences that also takes us into uncharted territory in terms of the effect on the psychosexual development of young people. I think we mustn't completely catastrophize. It can be very, you know, we can easily get drawn into slippery slopes, catastrophe, it's all going to the dogs. That we are made in the image of God still, and, you know, often even our defaced images or our being defaced images, people sense, there's something wrong here. You know, the sense of conscience that we still retain. And you know, so we've yet to see how this pans out. But for the moment, the consequences are, I think, are huge on our young people. Quite what they are, I'm not so, you know, I think we'd have to take quite a bit longer to sort of go into. Yeah, sorry, it's such a big question, and I know I'll be arm twisted out of the room in just 30 seconds. Yes, often enough, I think. Thank you so much, everybody, and see you.